Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Monday, June 13th, and the title of tonight's program is The Way Forward, a rather ambitious title, but it's because last week, Bruce Campbell was my guest, and we discussed Israel Must Perish. Now, that sounds good. And I think it sounded good to a lot of you, and it sounded good to me. Since then, I've thought that the problem with Israel perishing is that Bruce admits the plan, and that's in quotes, will be for most to come to the U.S. Now, you know, thinking about this a little further, I had to change my mind. I wasn't for it. I didn't like it to begin with, but now I like it even less. I mean, just think. Up to 8 million hardcore Israelis flooding in here, many Orthodox, many of Russian ethnicity, many Holocaust survivors or their children. A horrible situation. I mean, horrible. This cannot be a way forward. Israel Must Perish could even be a trick to put Jewry finally totally in control. When Bruce says, promise them anything to get them out of Israel and we'll deal with them here. Very dangerous talk. More likely, they will deal with us here. Where is the we that is going to deal with them? Why would they need Israel when they get the USA? I mean, they may be all prepared to make this switch and make this change, this trade, because when they come to the USA, they'll be treated like kings and queens, as per the negotiations that they work out beforehand. And yes, we will have a President Netanyahu. Oh, I mean, we have a President Obama now. And so a Jew will be next. Unless we take some concerted action in the other direction. The Israelis are certainly looking at the potentials and possibilities and making decisions accordingly, in my opinion. As we said last week, they are getting extra passports to the United States and other places, and they're readying themselves for various possible outcomes. So, in analyzing this, we can see that Israel is very unpopular. The future is not looking too good for them. Maybe they don't even have those nuclear weapons that we are worried about. Some people think they don't really have them, although that's a little, I don't think there's too much reason to think that. But it may not be as big a danger as we might think. Now, if they would agree to leave, they would suddenly become heroes also, like after World War II, and we'd all be saying, oh, how noble, how good of these Jews to make this sacrifice for the peace of the world, and on and on. It would be orchestrated totally in the media. They wouldn't be doing anything in which it would cost them anything. You can be sure of that. And the USA would be theirs for a good long while anyway, and long enough for them to take it all over. Now, these are just, you know, I'm not saying I know what would happen or what can happen, but these are real fears to be considered. And I say this too, aren't these Jews always a few steps ahead of the dumbbells, pretending to be our brilliant thinkers? And here I'm going to go to people like, because I'm going to hit at veterans today again, people like Gordon Duff and Alan Sobrowski. These are people that were mentioned by Bruce. And you know, I like Bruce, and he writes terrific stuff. I think he's the real deal. But then again, these connections that he has are really troubling to me. So I don't mind just saying it right out here. And that's what I'm doing. Now, do you really think that if we're listening to these people like Gordon Duff and Alan Zabrowski, that we're going to get the upper hand in the way that we need to, and we're going to gain the upper hand? No, this is not the way to go. This is just not the way to go. So what is the way? Well, the way is much tougher. And the right way ahead is always tough. It's never easy. We need to understand that whatever we do, whatever happens from here on in, it's going to be tough. We're in tough times. First, we need to decide on and spell out our Weltanschauung, which Weltanschauung is that wonderful German word that has actually become a word in the English language because it doesn't translate very well, and the English doesn't have a very good equivalent. But it sort of means a comprehensive worldview, not just a temporary point of view, but very, very all-encompassing worldview. And in a movement, a group working with power and with the idea of having power or regaining power, everyone has to have the same Weltanschauung. I would say you can't have everybody having different ideas. Now, in a nation, in your nation, there's going to be differences. But in the leadership of a movement or in the main body of a movement, you can't have those differences if you want to be successful. No diversity allowed. Now, right away, this upsets all the Democrats who want individual freedom for all and who think that it's a good idea that we all have our own idea, and we discuss it, and we talk about it, and talk it out. Well, you know, that talking goes on, and that's the problem that we have. So individual freedom equals group suicide. That's just the way it works. Now, what are some of the things that we are free to do now in our democratic way of life where we have all this freedom? Well, we're free not to have children. We're free not to work if we don't want to. We're free not to be educated if we don't want to educate ourselves. We're free not to be responsible if we don't want to be. We have sexual freedom. We have religious freedom. And we supposedly have academic freedom. This freedom is probably overvalued. I've always valued freedom highly, but now I see where a lot of freedom leads us as in the way that the world has gone since 1945 and even earlier. Freedom should not be our highest virtue or our highest ideal at all. Now, I want to just point out some basic thing here. We're basically divided politically between progressive on the one hand, and I'm going to use progressive instead of liberal because they love to call themselves progressives. Progressive versus traditional conservative, whatever that means. But what is progressive? Well, I've got four things that I came up with to try to sort of describe it all overall. Non-racist, UN-friendly, immigration-friendly, and internationalist, which is, you know, internationalist. We're all one world, we're all one people, and we can all get along, and we should all get along. And internationalist is kind of, let's not have too many borders, because we want to just free exchange and free movement all over the world. Okay, compared to the traditional conservative way of thinking, racialist thinking is okay, and don't like or trust the UN very much. No to immigration, and nationalist. In a nationalist worldview, continents, we have continents that are divided into sovereign nations of ethnically homogeneous people with blood connection. Now, the progressives really rail against this. When you start talking about blood, it drives them wild. The Weltanschauung we have to have is the group comes before the individual, and blood is the meaningful connecting link. It may not always be possible to have it this way, but it's the best way. It's the best way because it's natural. It comes naturally to us all. Some points I'll make here is that all people of the world belong to a nation that they recognize they are a part of. I think this is basically true. Even the Jews say that they are a nation now, and they believe they're a community of blood. I'm not going to go through all the news stories and the writings that they've come up with, but except for some of the religious ones who want to say that they're just a religion, but these ones also actually believe that they're a nation, but they're not, just not, God has not allowed them yet to come together as a nation. But once they follow God's will in the way they, these ones say they should, these certain Orthodox ones, not all of them, then eventually they will. So they're a community, they're a nation of blood also, according to their own selves. And since Jews cooperate together from all parts of the world, they do recognize that they belong together, because they do work together, no matter where they are, it seems, pretty much. Now, even better than non-Jews who know that they are blood related, but don't really work as well together as the Jews do. Now, every group needs its own nation space. That's the basic idea of nationalism. And where all its people can be together, and they should be together there, and that, because people who are members of a big family group, like a nation is, a blood-related nation, get along well. Now, of course, there are crossovers. Everybody's not pure-blooded, this or that, but that would all, you just have to go where you fit best. And that would be determined not only by you, but by the nation of others who would say whether you are part of them or not, if you are a very mixed person. Now, they should not be allowed in other space unless they have permission from them to be there, which is what I was just saying. So really, now I know some of you may be saying, well, who does she think she is? What, you know, I'm only putting out my ideas here of the way I think the Weltanschauung should be, the view of how things ought to be. So really, it's not that Israel must perish, or even Jewry must perish, which was my next idea that I had considered. But, you know, we can't say that what would we do? We're going to exterminate all the Jews? I mean, we're not going to go there. We didn't go there in the 30s and 40s, even though Germans were accused of it, but they didn't do that. And it's just not something, as Bruce said, that we can do. We're just not like that. So, but the Jews must go to their own group. See, right now, Jews are all over the world. They have seeded themselves into every nation, and they're, you know, working to influence everything everywhere. And this is what has to stop. This is what we would call Jewry must perish, the form of Jewry that we have now. They must go and live in their own nation with themselves. And now, if there's a, now, first I'll say, okay, I got a couple things to say here, but first I'll say that it can't be Palestine. Now, they have this Israel now, but that they've been there now for 50 years, and they have proven themselves unfit to be there. And it's not really theirs, and they're not really the indigenous people of that area. So what they have done is they have replaced the indigenous people, and they are going to have to go somewhere else. But not wherever they feel like, and not to nations that don't want them. They have to go to a place that has been set aside for themselves, for them. And, you know, I don't think you can do any better than Birbidjan, which Lady Michelle Renouf talks about. But that's, I'm not going to say what it should be, but that, it's that kind of a place, because for one thing, Israel is not big enough for all the Jews in the world to go and live there. They're all, you know, they don't have enough space now. So, and they can't expand there, so they have to go to another place that's large enough for them all to live in. This is a tremendous logistic problem, and of every other kind of problem. I realize that, but we're talking about what is the right way forward. What is the right way for the world to be the way it should be, and the best way it can be, and this is the right way forward, difficult as it, and even impossible as it might seem. Now, as you can see, my idea is that nationalism is the best form of government. And I can hear you saying, but this just ain't going to happen. You know, this just ain't going to happen. You're wasting your time talking about it. But I'm saying whether it's going to happen or not, it is the right way forward. So just think, that I think like we're back at the end of World War II. You know, at the end of World War II, they were remaking the world. You know, they remade the world into what we have, the democracies, the victorious democracies, and they remade the world in their image of what they called democracy, which didn't resemble that very much, but, and now we have the result, you know, of what they did. And we see that, it has failed. It has failed, just like so many things. Just like I was talking on a couple of programs about Czechoslovakia and how they created Czechoslovakia at the end of World War One, and it just simply failed before World War Two started. And this whole system that they've created has failed. And so it's time to start with a new plan. Now, going back to Bruce Campbell, he seems to think that it's a shame that Germany lost the war. Now, I commend him for that. Good thought, Bruce. I think he does believe that. But his friend, and here I go again, but he speaks highly of him, so I think I can call him his friend, Gordon Duff, does not think that it's a shame Germany lost the war. So they don't agree on that. But let's see what might have happened if Germany had won the war. Now, I'm not going to really say everything that might have happened, but I'm going to quote here from Heinrich Himmler, showing the idea that maybe would have been in place. Heinrich Himmler was talking here sometime during the 40s, while the war was going on, and he said, "I don't believe that the communists will try anything because their leaders, just like most other criminals in our country, are in concentration camps. Something must be said here. Only after the war will it be seen what a blessing it was for Germany that we locked this whole criminal underclass up in the concentration camps. If they were running around loose, it would be much harder for us, particularly since they would then have their subordinate officers and commanders. They'd have their workers' councils and soldiers' councils. But this way, they're all locked up and are making grenades, artillery shells, and other important things, and are very useful members of human society." Well, of course, this was wartime, and so they were making grenades and artillery shells and so on. But during peacetime, if we had people who were just causing trouble in our society, and we put them in concentration camps and put them to work, they would be making other things. They would be working and doing something productive and be useful members of human society. And if people have to be put into a camp to be a useful member of society, then that really is their problem. If they can show that they can be a useful member of society, they can be released from the camp. And certainly, those early camps, people were released, and they tried to rehabilitate these people if it was possible, and they were then released back. But if they reoffended, then when they went back into the camp, they didn't have it quite so easy, and they didn't get out so early. But anyway, going on with Himmler here, he also said this. He said, "We repeatedly sought out and rejected that which was not suitable, that which did not adapt to us. As long as we possess the strength to do this, this order," well, he was speaking about the SS, but I'm changing it to nation, "this nation will remain healthy." Now, you know, this kind of language sounds very offensive to people because we've been brought up and trained in this democratic idea that you just can't treat, you know, you just can't say things like this, and you can't reject people, and you can't force people to adapt to you. You just take them as they come, and you adapt to them. But this doesn't work, as we can see what it's done, especially to us, white European peoples. So we have to get used to this kind of thinking. That's why I'm bringing it up. That's why I'm reading his words here. Because if people are not suitable to us in our society, it's up to them to adapt to the society. It's not up to the society to adapt to them. And Himmler goes on, The moment we forget the law of the law of selection and severity with regards to ourselves, then the germ of death will lie within us, In that moment, we will perish, just as every human organization, every prime of life in this world, comes to an end at last. Well, I think we're all familiar with that. I think we realize that this is happening to us. This is not fanciful, and that means we have to be tough. Again, we have to accept severe standards for ourselves and our societies. The moment we forget the laws of the racial foundation of our people, he says, we're in trouble. Now, going on, for that reason, it is our duty, whenever we meet and whatever we do, to remember our principle, blood, selection, severity. Again, this is not easy language to accept and to take in. But what does it really mean? Our principle, blood, our blood relation. There is no better way to ensure that your group is going to hang together, work together, survive together, care about each other, and do as in its highest potential, than to have that blood connection. It just works that way. You can't substitute anything else for it. It's just words. So, and selection means you select the best. Now, of course, he's talking about the SS, which he was in charge of, and so they selected the best, and they were very severe in their rules, in their expectations, in everything, so that they would not falter and fail. And so we're talking here probably more about the leadership of a nation and the movement that is formed to regain leadership in a nation, and that's where the severity has to come in. But in the mass of the people, you don't expect it that much, you know, that strongly. And things are a little more relaxed. But in the leadership, this has to be. Now, another thing I like what he says is never to deceive ourselves, but rather to remain genuine at all times. That must always be our endeavor. That is what we must advocate and inculcate in ourselves, in every young man and woman, over and over again. I like that, not to deceive ourselves. This is not a bunch of criminals who are trying to put something over on people, and this is honest people who want to be honest with themselves, who don't want to deceive themselves because they want to be genuine. What is it to be genuine? It's to say what you really think and believe, and to be what you really are, not to pretend to be something else so that you can please everybody and please others who are outsiders. We shouldn't be trying to do that. That's the job of the progressives. All right, I have a little quote here from Joseph Goebbels, also in this regard, that I thought was interesting in connection with what I'm talking about. And Goebbels wrote this in January 1929, and is titled "The Jew." This is just the first paragraph. He wrote, "Everything is discussed openly in Germany, and every German claims the right to have an opinion on any and all questions. One is Catholic, the other Protestant. One an employee, the other an employer. A capitalist, a socialist, a democrat, an aristocrat. There is nothing dishonorable about choosing one side or the other of a question. Discussions happen in public, and where matters are unclear or confused, one settles it by argument and counterargument. But there is one problem that is not discussed publicly, one that is delicate even to mention, the Jewish question. It is taboo in our republic." Well, this was the time of the Weimar Republic, 1929, 4 years before these National Socialists did move into the power position and began making some changes. But, you know, then it was the same then as now, and it was the same going back very far, quite a ways back, when it became taboo to talk about Jews or to mention Jews. Anything else could be mentioned. As we hear that said so often today because of all the quote-unquote Holocaust laws, people say, well, gee, how come we can't talk about this? How come we can't ever question what the Jews are doing? Well, because they were in control then, and they're in control now. But for a while in Germany, they were not in control. And that made them so mad that they punished Germany as badly as they possibly could. And so what we're up against is not something easy, that's for sure. It's tough, but we need, here's one thing I think we need to do. We need to stop thinking, talking, sleeping Israel 24/7 and take up our own cause, which is getting rid of the Jews among us, not bringing in more. So that's my answer to, or my response, I guess, to what my program was on my program last week. And I'm going to go on in the second half here, talking about several newspaper stories that I want to talk about, and starting out with a couple by Gordon Duff. That's not a newspaper story, but it's on his website, that I think will be instructive, I hope, at least it interests me. So we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after this news break.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Growing anti-Israeli feeling in Europe with calls on EU and US governments to stop ignoring the occupation of Palestinian land. And though politicians remain silent, activists rally to draw attention to the plight of the Palestinian people. Daniel Bushel has more from Brussels.
A day of rage against Israel. Thousands call for the boycott of Israeli goods over its continued expansion on Palestinian land. A Jewish demonstrator says enough is enough.
American leaders do nothing. The EU does nothing. The repeated UN resolutions have ruled Israeli settlements illegal.
Activists want the European Union to bar the main exports of the occupied territories, flowers and fruit. They formed human barricades at EU supply depots, stopping goods getting through.
Israel's Carmel brand market settlement produces and pockets the profit, but occupying forces who move in their citizens are committing war crimes under the Geneva Convention.
Public pressure is bearing fruit. Italy's biggest grocer co-ops banned food grown in the occupied territories. The world's largest security firm, G4S, has stopped work with Israeli checkpoints on the West Bank, admitting it breached human rights. Shareholders forced Belgium's Dexia Bank to sell its Israel arm over €1 million loans to settlements. Activists' next target is the firm laying rail links between settlements and Jerusalem, EU transport giant Veolia. Protesters are also seeking to file charges under international law against Israel over its construction of settlements, which the authorities are investigating.
Belgian police will pass these complaints on to the courts. Judges must rule if firms who buy food from occupied Palestinian land are complicit in war crimes.
Irish MEP Paul Murphy will join Gaza Flotilla, the biggest yet, to raise awareness of the situation. Nine activists were killed by Israeli commandos when a similar operation was stopped in international waters last year. Murphy feels things have got so bad, he's ready to risk his life.
Hopefully people aren't killed this time as they were last time by the Israeli military forces, but that it brings the world's attention to this issue.
Such moves, say experts, force politicians and business to act.
The public opinion changed their mind. Before they were thinking that Israel was aggressed by the Palestinian. Today, public opinion have a real capacity to challenge and the international institution, the European institution and the UN, and also the big company.
The last time such a campaign was mobilized internationally was against the South African.
let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, and I'm going to go quickly through these two articles by Gordon Duff, because I have some others that I want to talk about. And time does go by fast, so I'm going to try to hit the high points here. And the reason I want to talk about these is because, it's this idea that Gordon Duff goes after the Jews is totally false. He goes after Israel and Zionists, mostly connected with Israel, and not much else. When he does it, the way he does things is very strange. And, it's my opinion that he and the website Veterans Today is a disinfo site. That doesn't mean everybody on there is the disinfo agent and that they think of it that way. They're sincere, and some of them are sincere. Some of them I'm not, I don't know. I think there's quite a few strange characters on there, but it grows and grows. There are so many contributing editors now. There's so many articles on there. It's total confusion. And I think the point of that site is to confuse people. That's what disinfo is supposed to do, confuse you and keep you from ever following along in a real thread like I was talking about in the first half, the way we need to look at things and the way we need to hold fast and all agree together instead of having all these hundreds of opinions. So the first article is False Flag Racism. Now, just right there, the title, he's got to put that racism in there. It's about racism. He really likes to promote the idea that that there is racism, although in this article he's supposedly saying that racism is a false flag. It's phony. It's created by Jewish groups like the Anti-Defamation League in order to make this Nazi threat to scare the Jews, who he is basically saying are being misused and are good people and so on. So he's not attacking Jews. He's just attacking certain groups, and he's trying to connect them with, what do you think, Nazis? I've been over this before because I've had quite a few programs where I talk about Gordon Duff. Now, in the beginning of this article, there's a little blurb from Jim W. Dean, who is Veterans Today managing editor, and Gordon is the senior editor. And Gordon Duff's name on his, they've redesigned that website, and his name on his column and on his articles is the biggest anywhere on the site, and it's bigger than the Veterans Today heading at the top. It's huge, and so is his face on there. So, he really is a self-promoter and gets worse and worse with it. But anyway, Jim Dean mentioned that in this little blurb that a good friend who works for the Anti-Defamation League told him something. Now, I thought, oh, he's got a good friend who works for the Anti-Defamation League. I mean, it's one thing to have a good friend, a good Jewish friend. You could have Jewish friends. A lot of people do. But one who works for the Anti-Defamation League, and he wasn't working there to find out things and give. He was working there seriously. And he just happened to mention how they own, he says they own all the Nazi and white supremacist websites on the internet. Well, what they call Nazi and white supremacist, so what? So, he says that, the things I want to point out here, and I'm taking too long already, I wanted to talk about that little graphic they have, but I don't have time. But they do use this star of David. And I've seen it more than once, but it's on the graphic here. And it's that one that's got a swastika entwined on the inside and the Star of David on the outside, and it's all one line that goes around and around. That's one of their favorite symbols, because the big thing that Gordon Duff is doing is trying to make Israel and Israeli Zionism equal to Nazism. That's the whole thing. But to leave out all the majority of the Jews in the world who are not a part of that, see. Now, he says organizations like today's Stormfront were used by the FBI to track blah, blah, blah. See, now, back during the 80s, organizations like today's Stormfront were used by the FBI. It doesn't, now why is he even bringing it up? Because he wants to connect Stormfront with the FBI. Why doesn't he just say what the organization was? He says then later, he says it was the most notorious of all of these was the Michigan Militia. Now, I don't know anything about the Michigan Militia, but I don't know if it's anything like Stormfront. Is a militia like Stormfront? Who knows? But, you know, this is the way these things are done, to put words together that the people who are reading this, who are not as sophisticated as they think they are, have these words put together, and that sticks in their mind more than what is actually being said, because what is actually being said is really hard to figure out. It's purposely difficult, written not well and not clearly. So you don't really know what the heck it's all about often when you're done with it, but you have been impressed with a lot of connections that he's making. And so he makes the connection between the white supremacists and anti-Semites who were the militia leaders, and their chosen candidate, he says, was George W. Bush. Now, I have never known any white supremacists or anti-Semites who liked George W. Bush, but that's what he's trying to tell us here. Now, he's talking also, he has to bring up Hitler a lot, Hitler and the Nazis, and he says that they were in these white supremacists these Jewish groups were secretly connecting the white supremacist internet groups as a threat against the Jewish community. He says, by manufacturing a threat, much as Hitler had done when he blamed the Jews for Germany's downfall in World War I. Well, come on, Gordon. Get on to speed here with your history. To say that Hitler manufactured a threat when he blamed the Jews for Germany's downfall is not correct. It maybe wasn't only the Jews who contributed to Germany's downfall in World War I, but they certainly played a part, particularly at the end, with causing Germany to give up and go along with the armistice, which turned out to be a big fraud. And that was the Jews for sure, and that is what Hitler was always generally talking about. But, Gordon wants us to think that Hitler was just doing a false flag thing here again. And so also, he says that the Bush administration's talk about family values and compassionate conservatism was hate mongering, was thinly veiled hate mongering against Jews and African Americans. He likes to always, say that the Republican Party is really hateful toward Jews and African Americans. And then he also says that welfare cheats and left-wing intellectuals are code words for blacks and Jews. He's always supporting the blacks and Jews as a progressive that he says he is. So that fits. But here's something. He says the real Nazis moved into the mainstream of the Republican Party, and then they, by doing that, the FBI became a close ally and blah, blah. But, the real Nazis, moved into the mainstream. Who were the real Nazis? They became the Republicans. That's his latest thing. He's connecting Republicans and Nazis in several places. And he says that they blew up buildings, etc., and then they became government snitches. But to go on with what I don't want to miss out on, he says Jews have always been leaders of every progressive movement, forming the core of civil rights organizations, trade unions, environmental groups, and organizations tied to government reform. What he's saying here is that these Jews are wonderful members of our society. They have been leading progressive causes. They have been in the forefront of all these very good progressive topics, or not topics, but you know what I mean, efforts, which all progressives are for, and this we can thank the Jews for. And but he says then that this had to change, and with 9/11 they changed it, and they brought in Israel to be closely allied with the right wing. And this and the Nazi and racist ideology. So he says internet organizations known for their racist or Nazi ideology became tools such as AIPAC. So now we've got AIPAC is a Nazi ideology, you see, because he is going after Israel. He's going after AIPAC. He's doing things like this to make himself look like he's a real hard-hitting journalist here and on our side or on the side of whatever good, you know. And the Nazis are being put in with the Jews, Israel, and AIPAC. I've talked about this before, but the thing is, it's still going on. Then he has the next section is subtitled Anti-Semitism, and he talks about the unholy alliance between traditional anti-Semitic groups in the U.S. and the Israel lobby, which they had to form, and defenders of Israel, people who are traditionally Republican, really, became defenders of Israel. And then he says, defenders of Israel, but still haters of Jewish Americans. So here we have it. You know, you can be, the message is you can be a defender of Israel, but still hate Jews. So these defenders are the real haters, like the Christian Zionists. And I'm, you know, I don't like Christian Zionists, but he goes after Christians. And some others of these that he goes after, Christians, and he goes after the neocons, and he goes after Republicans. So he lumps all that together. He always lumps the Republicans in there. And he's always going after the Bushes, and I think that's going to be in the next one. But and then he says later, Nazi organizations are now run by Israeli intelligence. Well, are these Nazi organizations? Why is he calling them that? I really don't know very many Nazi organizations, and if there are any, they are really small little things that are totally unimportant. So nobody's, you know, I don't know, he's carrying on here in these ridiculous articles, and yet people think that they're really great. They think, oh, he's really exposing something here by exposing that it's the Jews who are behind this. But he's always exonerating the majority of Jews. Now, the next article by him is Wiener and the Washington Cesspool. Now, in this article, of course, he's supposed to be talking about Anthony Wiener, but instead he doesn't. You know, he's a... the kind of journalist he is, he has to talk about the Anthony Wiener case. He can't ignore it. And so what he does is here, he says he's talking about it. He writes this article, but he spends all his time talking about Republicans. Now, in this article, he mentions Wiener in the first paragraph and the last paragraph, and that's all. And he says, oh, yeah, Wiener's a scumbag who never belonged in government or any position of trust whatsoever. He should resign. But he says Wiener's problem isn't his morals, it's that he shares so many core GOP values. Now, to figure out what that means, you know, that's supposed to be, I suppose his fans think he's being just really, oh, you know, he's just says such outrageous things. We have to read and find out what he means by that. Well, all he means by that is that he brings up sex in Washington. And he says that he has to say that the abuse of priestly office that brought the Catholic Church low is small potatoes compared to what goes on in Washington. Well, you know, he doesn't need to talk about the Catholic Church at all. And he certainly could say the abuse of the rabbis, that the rabbis carry out, that has, you know, impugned the Jewish religion. And what about Wiener? And what he represents. But he doesn't. He talks about the Catholic. He mentions the Catholic Church, as he always does. And now he says he mentions the carefully orchestrated press blitz against Wiener. Well, you know, Weiner himself caused all this by his silly egotism about his own sex, his sexual needs or whatever. And so the press only had to pick it up normally. I wouldn't say that there was a carefully orchestrated press blitz against Weiner. But he says they did this in order to cover up what McCain and Lieberman are doing, that these guys are, you know, doing something with the bill. And in order to cover that up, you know, they're making a big deal about Weiner. I don't think so. Now he talks about, now here's another wild one. Monica Lewinsky should be thankful she went after Clinton, not Cheney, as with Chandra Levy, believed to have been tasked with targeting the vice president. Ha! Huh. You really think that Chandra Levy was targeting Vice President Cheney? That's a weird one. I don't think Vice President Cheney was too susceptible to young women or sexual things. I don't think that's where his interest was, and I think that's just a nutty thing to say. That's probably some of his... He's always telling us that he's got this inside CIA information, because you must know, and I think I failed to mention this time, that Gordon Duff is half Jewish. Yes, he's a half Jew, and he's out of the CIA. He's former CIA, and so many of these people are. I mentioned Alan Sobrowski earlier. He's a quarter Jew, and so many people. Did I say already that so many writers on the on Veterans Today are Jewish? They're just, you know, a lot more than is normal, but then that is, you know, in the population structure, but then that is common with writers everywhere, all over the internet and in the media. And then he goes after George W. Bush, and then he picks up the Franklin affair, and then he finally goes back to Weiner, and all he says is, yes, he has to go, he's an embarrassment. But think about the town that's filled with thieves and war criminals, and he goes back to talking about the Bushes again. Now, that's Gordon Duff's contribution to talking about going after the Jews and going after Weiner, which he doesn't really do at all. Okay, you know, I'm a little behind here, so I'm going to go into my just one article. And that is why women are important in the way forward. A Women Give Neo-Nazi Scene a Facelift is an article that was in a German newspaper. Actually, it's a book that has, it was a review of a book. A book has come out in Germany, and it's supposedly exposing certain things about the right wing. They call it the right extremists. And I don't know who these people are who wrote it, but they are definitely left-wingers, and they're complaining that the NPD, which is, of course, the real, true Nationalist Party in Germany, is not prohibited in Germany. Of course, it's been called to be prohibited many, many times. They want it to be. They don't think it should be allowed in Germany, but the Supreme Court there cannot, you know, in any good way, prohibit it, because they have freedom, supposed to have freedom of expression there in their constitution. And so it continues, although it's always being bashed. But these writers say in this book that the NPD is using women, and the right in general uses women, to lure people into their right extremist movement. And they say that women are used as ambassadors for the movement. Children wins the hearts of people much more easily than a young man with tattoos, chanting slogans, and so on. Many people think if women are a part of it, it can't be so bad. Well, you know, that's very true. Women are good for a movement like this. And we need to look for more women, and we need to encourage women, but they should be just mainstream type women, people who look mainstream. And who are mainstream, like me. But we need a lot more, and we need young women and women women with families, family women. But now let me go on with this, what they're saying here. Because, you know, they get attacked, so these have to be strong women to be in a right wing movement. At second glance, they say These women, you know, they say they look fine, and people say, oh, these women must be, it couldn't be too bad if these women are in it. But then they say, but then one notices the Prussian rigidity with which the mothers raise their children. It's a harsh approach that glorifies discipline and German tradition. Ha! Now, what is this? What is this harsh approach that they say they take, these nice German mothers? This breed refused to use English words that have long found their way into colloquial German. Now, you know, there was a real effort to anglicize the German language. And it got so far that they were changing the spelling of and getting rid of the umlauts and all this stuff. And then somehow it got turned around and there was resistance, and all that has been stopped. But now here are some examples of what these mothers are doing. They're teaching their children not to say T-shirt, according to these authors anyway, but to say T-hemd, which is the word in German for a shirt, hemmed. And instead of saying internet, they want them to say Weltnetz, which is German for world web. And instead of saying pizza or pizza, they say Gemüsetort, which means vegetable cake. And this is just terrible, isn't it, that they're not going along with this English slang and so on, and American slang, but are insisting on sticking with their German words. It's just nuts. That's the best they've come up with against these women. Now, but they also go on and say you should not underestimate the power and reach of women. See, they're worried about this because there's a picture here where there's some demonstrators for the right party. And there's three women and three men in the picture, but it's small, hard to see. But the women look very nice, normal, you know. And so they're really worried that these parties will gain some traction and they are gaining in some places. So they say, you know, this is something to worry about, and we need to stop this and discourage women from getting into these parties. And then they complain that the women don't stay within their own extremist enclaves, but they go out and are employed as social workers or caregivers and are dealing with children where they can influence them. And this is just horrible. They expect that these women who are on the right should just be stuck in their own little extremist enclave and not be able to get out of it and be a part of the rest of society. Now, I have a couple of minutes is all to talk about this Strache, Heinz Christian Strache, leader of the Freedom Party in Austria, and his visit with Marie Le Pen. They met in Strasbourg. She's the head of the National Front in France, and both of them are doing very well. And I don't have time to go into the silly story, the funny story, how this journalist tried to embarrass Strache when he was there because of this debate in the city of Amstetten in Austria about whether Hitler should have his title of honorary citizen of the town that he was given way back then, that they never did away with it, and now they had a big deal that, you know, all these politicians from that little town had to rush and vote to take this title away from Hitler. And now, because I'm hurrying, I'm getting mixed up, the Freedom Party members did not vote on it, so they were being criticized. And he criticized Strache while he was with Le Pen in this meeting. But the fact is that Le Pen is seen as neck and neck with the French President Nicolas Sarkozy in popularity polls in France. And also Strache has good chances to come in first in the next federal election, according to surveys. So, you know, as I was talking in the first half about what seems like such an uphill battle, it can never be done, and yet there are a lot of people who are ready, who could be ready, and we just have to work hard. It makes a point here that Strache has worked very hard over the past years, quite a few of them. He goes out in the countryside to festivals and nightclubs, and he tries to reach young voters. And the research has shown that 1 in 5 Austrians younger than 30 want him as the country's next chancellor. So we must always be working on this. Now, the other thing I might be able to sneak in here is Jews in the Catholic Church. There's this horrible story about this David Maria Yeager, who's become a high official. But before I go into him, which I don't have time actually, I will just say that Pope Benedict went to Croatia because there's a cardinal there who they're trying to make into a saint, and he had to say that this cardinal was a defender of Jews in order to be able to say good things about him. Well, ladies and gentlemen, keep up.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.